This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Welcome to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Your chance to catch up on the best bits. And of course, hear some of our incredible guests and real life stories. We were looking behind the headlines. Portugal has recently ruled it illegal for bosses to contact their employees outside of office hours. Emails, calls. So what about here in the UAE? We were speaking to senior HR consultant Rohini Gill about what the law says, but also how we can navigate this, whatever side of the fence we're on. And Toby Simpson of the Striver app was on hand to share his experiences and why it's important to get clarity and make boundaries from the outset. Speaking of what's legal, Ludmila Yamalova joining us for our free legal clinic. We were talking about that retirement visa. What's the criteria you need to have in place if you want to grow old in the UAE? And she was taking your questions too, from unpaid bills to wills for Muslims. And we were talking books with Alison K. Williams. She's an editor, an author, a writer, a coach. And she was talking about the books that she loves to return to time and time again. So if you're looking for some old favourites, check out her recommendations. And we loved hearing what you readers have gone back to as well. And speaking to an author, Candace Carty-Williams has sold more than 150,000 copies of her debut novel, Queenie. It was a book that changed her life and has connected with so many internationally. So what's she working on now? She was visiting the UAE for the Sharjah International Book Fair, and we managed to catch up and talk about her latest projects, including the process of converting a book for the screen.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I'm pretty sure everyone listening will have experienced this. You're having, let's say, a lie-in on a Friday morning. You're in the supermarket. You're in the playground with your little ones. When your phone rings, it vibrates, it's your boss. What do you do? If you pick up, chances are you're going to be asked to do something, or they're keen to have a, you know, a quick chat about a project. If you don't pick up, there could be consequences. Maybe there won't, but you'll definitely be thinking about it for the rest of the weekend. I want to know from you, what would you do in this situation? We're talking about this because Portugal has banned bosses from contacting their staff after work hours. That includes text messages, calls and emails. It's part of new laws dubbed right to rest. Companies with more than 10 staff could face major fines if they contact employees outside of contracted hours. But before you Google how to move to Portugal, let's get the thoughts of senior HR consultant Rohini Gill. Rohini, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am well. I'm very curious about this next hour because it's quite a divisive topic. And I think, you know, I'm curious to get your thoughts. This recent announcement from Portugal, what was your reaction to it?
Fantastic.
Yes. Why?
High time. fantastic. Do you know what the problem is, Helen? Problem is we as society treat rest as a reward and not as a necessity.
I could not agree more. You kind of think, I've got to deserve a rest. I'm working really hard, so now I get to have a rest, rather than, if I don't have a rest and incorporate this into my daily life, I'm going to be burnt out, unproductive, and probably foul.
Exactly. And employers need to remember that rested employees are productive employees. I am so happy that this has happened. I know there'll be a lot of employers saying, oh my goodness, Rohini's lost the plot. I was talking to a client not so long ago, about half an hour ago, and I said, you know, this is what we're discussing. And she said, what? In capital letters. And I said, yes, but it needs to come from the top. Mm-hmm. We, you know, if my boss's boss didn't have to reply, it would filter down. And this is it. We need to appreciate boundaries, and we just need to appreciate that employees need rest. They need time out.
Have you in your time seen disputes between staff and bosses that arise from not having that clear boundary between work hours and after work hours?
Lots. Absolutely lots. I think there's a fine line. Okay. Now, and it comes down to responsibility. Mm-hmm. If there's a project that's time sensitive, it's expected. You know, at the end of the day, if the project fails, then the company fails, employees suffer. So there's that aspect of it. But it should be an exception and not the norm. And this is where problems begin. I've seen lots of problems where managers think it's okay to for mundane matters to call employees at 10 o'clock at night. It's not okay. It's not okay. Mental health is important.
I think I
remember. So yes, a lot of it, sadly.
A number of messages on both sides of the argument coming through. And I remember back in the day when friends of mine would be given Blackberries by their bosses, and it was, you know, seen as a bit of a company perk. Oh, you get to have a Blackberry and we'll pay your bill. But we own you. This was the trade-off. And I think, you know, we live in a world now where everything's on our smartphone. It is so hard to disconnect. And there's almost no excuse logistically why you can't read an email, read a message or take a call. Do you feel like this is a problem that's got worse because of technology, or has it always been the case? It's just been a different way of getting in touch.
I think it's got worse because of technology. But the reason we are having this conversation today and Portugal's done what it's done is because after COVID, after all the work from home, people reassessed their own priorities. So what was okay 2 years ago is not okay anymore. Mm-hmm. This has been going on for ages. Technology has made it worse, but COVID's brought it to the forefront.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Portugal has banned bosses from contacting their staff after work hours as part of a new set of laws that promote work-life balance. Amazing news. Congrats, Portugal. Here in the UAE, lines seem to be somewhat blurred, and unless you're a healthcare worker or a journalist covering breaking news, what is a good excuse to answer a call? What's a good solution to this? Imad saying it's about time it becomes a law everywhere. It's time for a change. And Martin saying many times we're our own worst enemy. For most functions, the first thing not to do is be logged onto your company email on your personal phone. Oh, yes, if only. Rohini Gill joining us, senior HR consultant. And what do you think some good solutions are for managing those boundaries that seem to be trampled all over by many a boss?
Very simply, staff need to make boundaries clear to staff, to their bosses. I'll tell you what I do. I say to my team, I will email you at crazy hours. I do not expect a response. Travel's opened up again. People are traveling. It's you know, letting them know it's okay but within working hours or whatever their working hours are. It's all about redefining boundaries, Helen, I think. That's what it's come down to. It's to redefine them again.
I think a lot of people respond out of fear, out of, you know, what will be the consequence. You know, we heard from Ludmilla earlier that legally there is no consequence. You know, if you have overtime, that is negotiated and agreed and paid. But often it's the, oh my goodness, what if I don't reply? I'm going to be in the bad books. I'm dreading seeing them. Then, you know, next time I speak to them, it's going to be horrendous. So I don't know if there's an easy solution because every situation is going to be different. But it's really interesting to hear people's thoughts on this in 4001. Majab saying, as a manager, I try not to contact people out of hours because I don't want to foster a culture where people feel they need to be available and responsive all the time. I hate presenteeism in all its forms and don't want to encourage it. Majib, you sound like an awesome manager. Thank you for sharing that. And Polly saying, I work hours to fit around family life to do work in the evenings. I'll prepare an email, leave it in drafts and send it the next morning. Makes me look diligent sending emails at 8 a.m. I won't send emails after 7 because I think it then looks like I'm having to work late to catch up. Interesting, isn't it? The kind of ideas of perception, Rohini. So for anyone that's having a dispute with their boss or is planning a dispute with their boss, shall we say, about lack of respect of working hours, what can employee do to present themselves and their argument in a way that's not going to, well, let them, you know, out on their ear with no job at all?
Speak to your boss. I always go back to communication. Speak to them. Tell them what your concerns are. They will address it. Bosses are human, believe it or not. They will address it. They will sort it out. But also let them know that if it's urgent, so a code can be in the subject matter. If the manager says urgent, that means it needs looking at. So have a code, have something going with them. And the manager can say, well, you know what, if I call you two consecutive times or whatever works for the manager and the employee, have a code. So business doesn't suffer, business can't suffer, but employees' well-being and mental health can't suffer either. It's a fine line, Helen, and it's a fine line teams and staff can only have with their managers. It's what works for them. What might work for you may not work for me. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Thank you so much for that. It makes a lot of sense. Mahini Gill joining us, senior HR consultant.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Have you ever had a persistent boss who won't stop messaging once you've left the office or logged off? In Portugal, that behaviour is now illegal. The country recently introduced a law that bans employers from contacting workers outside their regular hours by phone, message or email, saying the employer must respect the privacy of the worker, including periods of rest and family time. Any violation constitutes a serious offence and could result in a fine. Let us know your thoughts, whether you are a manager who's got pressure on you and you ultimately need to put pressure on your employees, or if you're someone whose phone does not stop buzzing and you wish they would buzz off. Lots of you getting in touch. Loz saying, use delayed sending in MS Outlook. It works like a charm. No name on this one, and you can be anonymous, saying, my husband, a senior manager, is contacted day and night, early hours of the morning by colleagues. His workplace is 24/7. Let us know your thoughts. Toby Simpson joining us, recruitment expert, founder of Striver. Toby, be honest. Do you contact, you know what's coming, do you contact your staff outside of official working hours?
I have, yes, and I will continue to do so. I look, it's all about being, you know, being reasonable. And I am one of those individuals who totally believes in the psychological importance of having that separation between, you know, kind of work life and home life is something that's just help, you know, healthy and probably makes you better at your job. You know, for me, I used to kind of cross the bridge onto the palm, and all of a sudden there's that magical change of of atmosphere, or peel off the seat and
oh, your shoulders drop about 3 inches. But yeah. I mean, full disclosure, you know, I've worked in media magazines for a long time, and when there's a project, when there's a deadline, you have to hustle, you have to pull together as a team, and you have to get it done. I think Rohini's point earlier about it being the exception rather than the rule is a really key one. You could, you know, you could feasibly be working 24/7 and you're not being paid for that time. But I think where the complication, the confusion, the conflict comes is that kind of guilt factor where boundaries haven't been clearly established from the outset. And when more and more of us want flexible working, that line becomes even more blurred. I'm wondering if you had any advice for setting boundaries with bosses and with ourselves as well. You know, when I went back after having a baby and I was working part-time, it wasn't my employers that, you know, wouldn't stop working. It was me. You know, I felt like I had to prove something. So I had to have a bit of self-discipline on those boundaries. But how can you set them, especially if you're coming into a new role, Toby?
I think it's very hard, and it grows increasingly hard with the kind of the new work from home and a bit of balance in work. There's not many professions outside of manufacturing where you don't have a sort of a peak demand at a certain time of the month or when there's a project on or whatever it might be. And if you have the correct team ethos, everybody pulls together and wants to get stuff done. And sometimes that means, you know, sort of working beyond your hours. But then at other times, your mum's in town and you want to take the morning off to, you know, do some shopping. And that's kind of absolutely fine. There's give and take in a team scenario. I think probably what this is targeted at is that kind of systematic understaffing and sort of, you know, you push people beyond where they should be pushed to get the most out of them to maybe try and save your payroll costs. And ultimately, it comes to a question of, how do you allow for that very natural, flexible working scenario where, you know, you do need to, you know, call someone on a Thursday night because they haven't sent you something and you're not exactly about to tell to the person you're about to be on the phone to the US that maybe they can wait till Monday morning. So, you know, you do need to call someone and tell them to put down their apple juice and send you that info. And that's normal as long as it's not all the time. So there's two ways of tackling it. There's regulation, which is the way the Portuguese seem to have gone about it. And that would stifle natural economic competitiveness, and some of it very reasonable. And then there's the free market. So the free market would dictate that, you know, if what is being demanded of you by your employers is unreasonable, naturally, you'll probably go and look somewhere else. So ultimately, people, you know, that company will suffer and have to change its ways or fail because its qualified staff are leaving them. There is a kind of a proviso to the ability of the free market to regulate itself. And that's when, you know, for example, a small manufacturing town in, let's say, Portugal, obviously, because that's where it is. There's one show in town. There's that one factory. And unless you want to move away and you may have family reasons for having to stay in that town, there is literally no other option other than to work for the employer there. And in that case, regulation would be helpful. I think that the only sensible way to go about it is, as ever, just be upfront about what the working culture is when you're about to employ someone and you know, be upfront as a candidate. You know, candidates will quite often come into an interview, you know, with the attitude of, you know, literally, you know, if you want me to hop around the office, just say the word, boss, I'm in. And then things change further down the line when they kind of get into the work culture. So if you can track, you know, if there's going to be a regulatory side of things, and if this is going to be a trend around the world, there must be a waiver, and we must be able to put in there it is necessary from time to time to contribute to the team, you know, outside of working hours, but this should not exceed whatever it might be, you know, 8 hours a month or something like that.
Toby,
and that's probably the sensible way.
It is, absolutely. I think clarity is key. So we'll be talking a little bit next about best practice if we do feel like we're being taken advantage of. So let us know your thoughts on this. Are you a manager who is kind of struggling with the demands put on you and therefore need to share that burden with the rest of the team? Or are you an employee who is perhaps bearing the brunt, or perhaps you're workplace, the company culture is fantastic? No name on this one saying, I really don't mind. I'm happy to assist as I like the flexibility the other way around as well. My boss would only do it if needed. David saying, as a business owner that permits the team to work fully flexible hours, it really is up to them whether or not they want to work under traditional after traditional hours end. We have goal-based roles and functions with deliverables. We finish by 4 p.m, then it's free time. We don't finish till 7, then so be it.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Work-life balance, as it happens, because we are discussing that recent decision by Portugal to ban out-of-hours working, or contact, rather, from bosses. You've been getting in touch with your thoughts on this on 4001 or on the ARN News Centre. ARN, you can tell I'm still taking medication for my cold. The ARN Play app. And on the phone as well, 0487155500. And Alex has been in touch. Here's his take on it.
I've seen colleagues, they get called out while they booked a weekend with their family. And they call them and they say, this is an emergency, especially under COVID circumstances. And there's no one but you can save the day. And that's tons of pressure on the employee itself, especially if it's linked to a time where the appraisal is in 2 months, or they're waiting for a promotion or any of that. And then they go and they put themselves out there, and then they still score bad in their appraisal, or they don't get that promotion, and it causes a massive demotivating atmosphere. And then as a boss of a company or management, they can't help but to favor the ones who always say yes under the label of flexibility and single them out from the ones who said no, because simply they're practicing their rights.
It's interesting, Alex's take there about that kind of maybe conscious or unconscious bias for those who are ready, willing and seemingly able to help outside of those traditional hours. Toby Simpson's with us, the founder of Striver and a recruitment insider. What would you say to that?
No, I think it's interesting from Alex. And it does remind me that, you know, there are companies out there and with an attitude that the employee is, minion's the wrong word, but they expect their people to live, breathe, to serve the company name and the, you know, the shareholders and that sort of side of things. And there isn't that healthy culture of mutual respect. You know, in the scenario he paints where, you know, an employee's booked time off to go off with their family, and literally it's a case that person has to save the day, then that could be the case in any company, but it's about how they deal with it. Mm-hmm. So, Alex was referencing about, you know, should that be reflected in his promotion or pay rise? Not necessarily promotion. That's on a whole bunch of different criteria, but certainly it should be financially rewarded, or at least financially compensated. If that person's had to take time off, had to sort of cancel a holiday perhaps they've already paid for, that should be compensated, and they should be given time in lieu at a later date that could be ring-fenced, and perhaps additional compensation on top of that. So it's about the right level of respect between both the employee and the employer. And then we reach, a compromise, which is, that saves the day in the case of emergency, and also it looks after the employee's well-being and their right to enjoy their lives.
Absolutely. And ultimately, we know that rested employees are productive employees, and then it comes back to your bottom line. It's going to take a very long time, unfortunately, for a lot of companies to catch on to that. Linda saying, occasionally I do read and reply out of hours, mainly because I enjoy my work and I'm interested in what's happening when I'm not there. But I read recently someone saying, don't read and reply to emails out of hours. You'll make yourself less credible. Interesting point. And Bilal saying, I've got more time for bosses who are able to model boundaried behaviour and don't spend time working during downtime, with the exception of emergencies. Bosses out there, please set an example. Bilal, thank you for that. Tough times ahead, everyone's feeling the pinch. So I understand the pressures, but my goodness, some kind of work-life balance, I think, is much needed for so many people who've got in touch this afternoon. Toby, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Well done to Portugal. Interesting to get us talking, get us thinking.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is time for your free legal clinic with Ludmilla Maliver standing by from HPL and Melvin Plucker. Ludmilla, thank you so much for being with us. How are you?
I'm well. To hear you and see you.
I know. Friend. Nice, hey? I am wearing my trainers, I promise. Look, there you go. Flashing my shoe to Microsoft Teams. Now, we touched on this last week about getting older in the UAE. And really, this is for good reason, because the retiree visa for expats has been brought to our attention. And I'm curious, from a legal point of view, if you can perhaps offer some clarity on what we know so far. What's the criteria?
Certainly. So, just to clarify, because there have been two different announcements over the course of a year about the retirement visa. One was specifically targeted towards Dubai. And then since then, in the last few months, there was another update which now extends the option for the retirement visa to the rest of the UAE. So the requirements for the Dubai versus federal retirement visa are slightly different. But so that's why, if somebody's listening and they thinking that the requirements they know about are somewhat different, it's because of the two types of visas, if you will. But in general, so under the federal visa, and this is important because this option applies to residents or anyone who is interested in living anywhere in the UAE, including Fujairah and Ajman and other Emirates. So the requirements are as follows. One is that there's a requirement of having an annual income of sorts of 180,000 dirhams. And this could be by way of a pension payment that they'd be receiving on a monthly basis, or some other kind of income, for example, from rental properties or some other investment payouts. And to prove that, they would also need to submit a six-month bank statement for the last 6 months. Also, in addition to this income of 180,000 dirhams a year, they will need to show investment to the tune of 1 million dirhams, either by way of property investment or a secured bank investment. Then also health insurance and a payment of 2,300 dirhams to apply for the visa. And with that, you will have a 5-year retirement visa.
There you go.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
The amazing, the incredible Ludmilla Maliver joining us live on the line in real time to take your questions, your queries, your concerns, the stuff that's maybe keeping you up at night, or maybe you just want some reassurances, a second opinion on all things legal here in the UAE. Someone called Minty has been in touch. Minty's my nickname from school. That's a bit strange. Hello, other Minty. Asking, what's the deal on freelance visas? Can you buy one to replace your work visa if you've lost your job? And how much is it? It's being advertised as cheap, but when I inquired, it's not that cheap. Thank you so much. Ludmilla, what do we need to know? The basics, please, on freelance visas and why the discrepancy with cost?
So freelance visa, in short, the authority through which you would apply for a freelance visa, the best authority, that is, as far as Dubai is concerned, is called DDA, which is the Dubai Development Authority. which now houses the TCOM, I guess previously was referred to as TCOM. So the Studio City and the Knowledge Village, Internet City and Media City, all of those free zones fall under DDA. So that's the authority through which you would apply for a freelance permit. And now to apply for a permit, the cost for a permit itself if you applying for the permit, but you also need a visa, the permit itself is about 8,000 dirhams. And then additional 4,000 or so, let's say 4,000 to 5,000 dirhams is for the visa. Plus the various application fees. And if you add the Emirates ID fee and the medical, let's say about 15,000 dirhams to apply your first year. And as part of this, you will have your own what's called a freelance license, a sole establishment, and you'll have your own visa. The visa is for 3 years. You can sponsor your family under it, and it is a work visa, so it's an employment visa, so you can definitely work. And also you'll have you'll need to have insurance and such. So about 15,000 dirhams for the first year. And then because the freelance visa is linked to a freelance permit, that particular permit is given, you need to renew every year. So if the visa is for 3 years, the permit is for 1 year. So you would need to renew the permit every year for additional about 8,000 dirhams.
Okay.
So cost-wise, if you add it all up, it's about 32,000 dirhams for 3 years. And that way you'll have 3 year visa and 3 year freelance permit. You'd apply actually through the DDA, and it's all online, and they'll forward you to the Go Freelance website, which we thought when we first discovered it, we thought it was almost like a third party private, mm-hmm. but it seems to be government related. Okay. So everything is done online. You don't ever have to go to any authority physically, obviously, until it's time to go for your medical and donate some blood. And it's rather efficient. Just within a few weeks, that you'll have both your license and your visa.
So you'll be legal to live here and make money.
And by the way, there's no requirement, which is important for all those who've looked at opening up or having their own visas by virtue of having their own companies. There's no requirement for an office or for a lease. There's no requirement for an audit or a bank account. So with regards to all these other costs that usually are attached to running a business in the UAE, mm-hmm. the freelance option is, while still not inexpensive, it probably is one of the most affordable and, for now, simplest options.
Good information, Ludmilla.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your free legal clinic this hour. Ludmilla Yamalova joining us live on Microsoft Teams to answer your questions, your queries, put your mind at ease and give you a bit of an action plan on anything that's giving you a headache or has you scratching your head. Number of messages for you, Ludmilla, going to the text line. And we've been talking visas, or obviously retirement visas, and no name on this one saying, recently resigned from my job, going to be travelling to join my husband overseas in 3 to 6 months. As I have a joint property in the UAE with my husband, can I apply for investor or 5-year golden visa based on my property here? Property value is 1.5 million dirhams plus. What are my options to continue to have a residency visa or the procedure as well? Thank you. What advice would you give to this listener, Ludmilla, about making sure that you're living here in a legal fashion, given that criteria that she's offering up?
The best advice is to apply for property visa on the basis of owning property with your husband, although it is jointly owned and the value of the property is not 1.5 million. The way the land department looks at it in terms of qualification for property visa is that at least your share is worth the value that it qualifies for property visa. In the past, that value was 1 million dirhams. In other words, if you had property that was worth 2 million and it's owned 50-50, then you would qualify. That rule has now been somewhat amended, and the land department will now also qualify those whose properties are worth 750 million thousand dirhams. So they've lowered the initial property value. So mm-hmm. based on if the property is now valued at 1.5 million, so your share in it will be 750,000, which means that you do qualify for property visa, and that property visa will qualify you for a 3-year residence visa. And it does become just like a normal residence visa and allows you to also work and sponsor your dependents. So that perhaps is the best way forward. And by the way, since you will be leaving town, there have been in the past concerns about having property visa and then having to come back into the UAE every 6 months. If you have a property visa, that requirement of checking in and coming back into the UAE every 6 months does not apply to all those who apply for property visa. So that requirement is no longer there either.
Thank you, Ludmilla. Great information as ever. Going to Wills now, and no name on this message, and as I always say, makes no difference. If you want advice, don't feel like you need to put your name on it if these issues are personal and private. No name asking, how do Wills for Muslim expats work in Dubai? Big topic when it comes to Wills, but what would you say to this specific situation?
I mean, the short of it is that they Wills, in a sense that non-Muslims understand them, they don't really, they're not really available to Muslims in the UAE. So this is because Muslims are by default subject to Sharia law. However, under Sharia, it's possible for a Muslim to have a will, but it's only a Sharia compliant will. Mm-hmm. And in relevant parts, that will has to be done through the court by and approved by a judge. And for a Muslim to will or to have a will, they can only give it to a non-heir, one-third of their, no more than one-third of their estate, and to a non-heir. So that would be a Sharia-compliant will. And again, it will have to be approved and registered through the courts. And then if you're talking about wills, for example, the ones that are being offered to non-Muslim expats through the DIFC or other similar venues that are extensively being offered by the Emirates as well, those are for now not available to Muslims.
Okay, hope that helps offer some clarity there. Talking money, money, money now. No name on this one, saying, I was placed on a reduced salary during the pandemic and have now resigned. Should the outstanding salary from the COVID reduction be added to my final payment?
In theory, yes, unless the original undertaking, which was signed with the company, would have provided otherwise. Because we did see a lot of companies who would have included in the beginning when they reduced the salary some kind of a commitment from the employees that they understood that this reduction was done on account of the challenges, financial challenges with the company, and that is that the salary will be reinstated, but will not be kind of reinstated retrospectively once things improve. So if it was an undertaking like that, then you know you wouldn't be, at least legally or logically, entitled to be looking back. But if there was no undertaking like that, then there certainly is a legal argument to ask for reimbursement of unpaid salaries.
Okay, good luck. Let us know how it goes. And Peter's been in touch on 4001 saying, what are my rights for not getting paid by an agent for work done as a freelance musician? I went to the police, but they couldn't help me. Have signed contracts. Thank you. So this is the joy of being a freelancer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a breach of contract. And so that is a civil matter. This is why the police would not have responded to it. In the past, cases like this might have also been held criminal, but not anymore, because anytime the police sees anything that stems from a contract, they do refer it to the civil jurisdiction. So that's why, don't be surprised. Now, this is it's just a breach of contract for services. So, for example, if you engaged a law firm or an accounting firm to provide services and they provide services, they have to be paid for. So it doesn't stem from an employment relationship, but rather from a services relationship. And whether there is a contract, a formal contract or some other kind of an undertaking that clearly establishes that services were provided in exchange for a payment, then you are entitled to by law for payment. If the agency is not paying you, the best and really the only option for you is to file a court case. And as I've said this before, and I want to reiterate over and over again, that the UAE, the blessing of COVID in the UAE has been that government services have really moved almost in their entirety online. And that includes court cases as well, or court proceedings, in particular with civil courts. So it's become a lot easier for parties and litigants to file their own court case without having to even go to lawyers or paying for local advocates or for legal consultants. They can just do everything through the online court system. You just need to have a login to the Dubai court system. And from there on, it's a fairly, it's in Arabic, but it is a fairly simple system to be able to file your own court case without leaving your home.
And is
something
it,
like this, that
is
would
it
be
expensive? Is it expensive to do that, Ludmilla? Because, you know, often when we think about, you know, unpaid fees, you think, well, is it going to cost more than actually I'm trying to chase and claim?
Not necessarily, because it's a percentage.
Okay.
It's depending on the claim. It's from 5% of the claimed amount. So it's not, you know, if you're doing something from 10,000 dirhams, it would be only 500 dirhams to file a case. So it's not that expensive. What becomes a little more expensive if you need to appoint an expert, for example, and there's another fee from anything from 5,000 to 15,000 dirhams. But those fees, if you do win, those fees are then recoverable. But otherwise, it's a percentage of the claim amount. So it's not, and if you take, for example, the fees for our local advocates or for legal consultants out of the equation, that obviously lowers your overall expense. It's really, truly has become a lot more affordable and accessible by virtue of just being able to do it online as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And time is money. We're all busy as well. So if you can do it from home in your pyjamas, all the better.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Your legal clinic is underway. Ludmilla Maliba is on the line. No name on this message, saying, I came to Dubai in the spring. I've had three positions, but no one has given me a work visa. Everyone promised me a visa after 30 days, then 60. Now it's impossible for me to find a job. Any advice for someone wanting a visa but can't get one? It's a really worrying situation there, Ludmilla. Have you heard of this before?
I have, and it doesn't surprise me. I think I'd recommend, although the price obviously is could be a factor, but the freelance visa perhaps is the best alternative here, because it does allow you to have your own visa. You self-sponsor yourself. You don't need to have an office. You don't need to do commit to a number of other commitments that you otherwise required when you set up your own company. And with that freelance visa, then you can work for different companies as sort of as a service provider. So that way, you have the option of working for a number of companies or one, and not have to worry about working and then not having a job or not having a visa, and more importantly, getting into trouble for working without one, without a visa, which is actually, it's an offense that can ultimately lead to deportation. I'd say, in general, I'd like to make a comment that all those who come here to the country and start work before they get a visa, it's actually illegal. And we have seen a number of cases where people get deported over such offenses. So I caution anyone to start working too soon.
Okay, yeah, it's very tricky. I mean, I understand what you're saying about the freelance visa, but I think for certain people in industries, the cost is just a bit prohibitive for starting up from nothing. But yeah, just companies out there, do better. Make sure your employees are living legally with that visa. No name on this message saying, I wanted to ask, as a non-Muslim Indian expat, does it make sense to have a will, especially if we have property here in Dubai?
Absolutely. I have to tell you, I would actually very much urge anyone who is a non-Muslim expat that has significant assets in the UAE, in particular real estate assets, to have a will. I'll just give you an example. We've been trying to enforce a Swiss will for a client and for over a year, and it's very, very difficult. So I would really, really encourage everyone to consider a local option.
Okay, I hope that helps. And question here saying, what's our company's options for a customer check that bounced due to account closure? What's the call to action there? Is there any way of getting what is owed?
Sure, the best option would be a payment order. It's an expedited court process that allows to file an expedited court case, for what's called a confirmed commercial debt. And a check qualifies as a classic example of a confirmed commercial debt or confirmation of a confirmed debt. So that would be the best thing to do, is to file a case through the court, again, website. You can file it through the website. You just need to have your own login to the court portal, depending on which emirate you're in. And then you file what's called a payment order. You present a copy of that check. And by law, there's specific provisions that address the payment order itself. The court has to issue a decision within a day or two. So that's just to give you an example. So that would be the best thing to do, is that you file for this confirmed commercial debt or payment order. You wait for the court to issue a decision, you serve the other side, and if it goes unchallenged, after 15 days, it becomes final and enforceable. And then you can move for enforcement proceedings, which means as part of the enforcement, then you can start seizing other assets that belong to the company and also request, for example, a travel ban and even arrest warrants for the officers of the company.
I really hope that helps. Now, coming up, last question, because after 3 o'clock, we're talking about Portugal banning bosses from contacting their staff after work hours. So no emails, no texts. In the UAE, what does the law say about this, if anything?
Well, so the federal law provides that the working hours in the UAE are 48 hours per week. Unless parties agree otherwise. Mm-hmm. And if parties don't agree otherwise, then the employees can work overtime, but they need to be asked to work overtime, and then they're entitled to additional compensation for the overtime hours. So it would be at 150% rate for their overtime. So let's say if your boss sends you a message after 7 p.m., to ask you to do something, then you could ultimately use that for that extra time. You would get extra compensation. Those who are in more senior positions or positions that ultimately kind of lead to a more flexible schedule, and then they agree not to receive overtime, then are not entitled to overtime.
Thank you, Ludmilla. Ludmilla Malova, thank you so much for joining us from HBL Malova and Pluka. Be back soon. Sorry if we didn't get to your questions. It's always a busy one on the legal clinic, but Ludmilla will be with us in a couple of weeks.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What is the one book you don't mind if maybe you love rereading over and over again? Talking old favourites worth rereading now with Alison K. Williams. She's an author, an editor, a speaker and a coach. Alison, before we come to your oldies, your favourites, what are you reading right now? What's on your bedside table?
Right now, I'm actually reading a book called Craft in the Real World by Matthew Salesis, and it's all about how, as writing teachers, we need to not impose a Western European sensibility on the writers who we're helping and critiquing in terms of getting their work into the world, and urging us to recognize different cultural practices for storytelling and how not everything should follow that traditional initiating incident, building action, climax, falling action of like the traditional Greek Western structure. I'm really enjoying it a lot, and I think it's helping me be a better teacher.
That's so interesting, because whether we realize it or not, so many books naturally follow that linear, you know, historical pattern that we grew up reading. But the big question is why or why not? How can we do things differently? Who's being overlooked because their style doesn't fit that traditional mold? That's fascinating. And I guess from your point of view as well, being able to recognize talent that might present in a different way as well.
Exactly. And if my student comes from, say, a background from Nigeria, there's a different storytelling technique that might be reflected in the way they write their memoir or the way they write their contemporary science fiction. And I love seeing how can we consider those cultural origins and make them translate to a worldwide audience, which is so important for writers here in Dubai, too, because so often we're writing for an audience beyond our own home culture.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Lots of people getting in touch saying what they're reading right now. Aruma saying, I often reread Little Men, Jane Eyre and Emma, a lot of that genre. Little Women is the one that I always seem to come back to. I just love that opening sentence, you know, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents. And I think a lot of it for me comes back to nostalgia. You know, when you reread a book, often you're trying to capture who you are or where you were the first time you read it. What are some of the books that you find yourself returning to, Alison?
Well, lately I've been returning to the work of Dorothy Sayers, in particular her book called Gaudy Night, which is a murder mystery with no murder.
What?
It's all about the women at Oxford College in the 1930s, and they're being disturbed by, they describe it as a cross between a poltergeist and a poison pen. And the real danger is that this college full of women will be viewed as mentally unbalanced, and it will, you know, harm their reputation as a college. And I love how the sleuth in the book is investigating. It's a woman sleuth, Harriet Vane, and she's investigating this whole anonymous letters and, you know, people's work being destroyed, people's books being thrown into the fire. But she's also investigating for herself is it possible to have a rich intellectual life as a woman and a satisfying marriage between equals? You know, can you have both of those things?
I have no idea. I think a lot of people are still asking themselves that question. Big time.
Exactly. So I love how, you know, I've gotten to the place in the book, this is probably my sixth or seventh time reading it. And when I reread a mystery, I love watching for the clues to, you know, what's the solution going to be? How did the author plant these clues? But I'm also loving how I consider for myself, you know, how is it that when we're with our partners, encouraging them to take risks, even though that frightens us, mm-hmm. is sometimes a really loving action. You know, we don't want to stifle them or control their creativity.
You're saying that to someone whose husband's just signed up to do another white collar boxing match. And I'm like, yes, dear. Yes, that's a great idea. I don't think I can come and watch you, but I encourage you to be your best self. Don't get hit in the face. Alison, we're talking next. One of your choices is Agatha Christie. So I am curious, when it comes to a murder mystery, what's the point in reading it again? We're speaking to Alison K. Williams.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Asking you, what book do you reread time and time again? It's like just snuggling up and having a hug. Alison K. Williams is with us. She's an author, an editor, a speaker and a coach, and she's talking about some of her go-tos. For Brian, it's Catch 22. Joffa is saying Stephen Fry's Heroes, his whole new take on adding humour to retelling Greek mythology is simply superb. That sounds brilliant. Man's Search of Meaning by Viktor Frankl says Don. And coming in on the text line is She's Come Undone by Wally Lambs. Thank you, Lana. So I've reread it at least 10 times, buy used copies every time I find one so I can pass along to other people. I've read it. I loved it. East of Eden by John Steinbeck, getting a shout out from Nisha. So what about you? 4001. Alison is flying the flag and making the case for rereading murder mysteries, which I find really interesting, to be honest. Even in Agatha Christie, even when you know who's done it, Alison?
Well, I find it so fascinating to watch how she constructs the clues. I love knowing, okay, it's probably, I'm pretty sure I remember it's this guy who mm-hmm. did it. But I love watching, oh, this conversation means something different than you think it does. That woman is fainting for a different reason than you think she is. And I just love admiring that mastery. Mm-hmm. I think it's really entertaining. And then also I'm not feeling like, oh, who did it? Will I be upset? Will I be disappointed? It's like, no, okay, a bad person will be punished and I'm cool with that.
I feel really torn about rereading books because sometimes I get a bit overwhelmed by how many books I want to read and it feels like a bit of a shame to read the same one again and again. But I do take so much comfort from it. I don't tend to read full novels, but I'll often reread short story books, something I can just dip into and maybe have an hour of something that, as you say, is really, truly relaxing. It's a bit like watching Friends. You know, like I know what's coming next and that's okay. I love the works of Curtis Sittenfeld. I love Melissa Banks. So these kind of short stories I find really, really soothing in a way.
I agree. It's comforting.
It is. Kate Atkinson is on your list. Life After Life. Why do you feel like everyone should read that and then reread it?
You know, I think Life After Life is just one of the most beautifully written and complex books. And the conceit of the book is that Ursula, the heroine, she makes a decision and we see how that plays out in her life. And then her life starts over, often because she has died. And it's fascinating to look at, you know, it's that butterfly effect thing. How does one tiny choice, oh, I'm going to go through, I'm going to go home through the lane instead of by the road. Mm-hmm. And how does that choice affect the entire rest of her life and change who she is as a person? And I love watching her throughout the book grow stronger and stronger until she can carry out her destiny, which is to alter history. And I think the author has done a really great thing, which is that in the prologue for the book, there's about a page and a half where we see what that destiny is going to be. She's, you know, we all have this fantasy about, you know, what would have happened if somebody had stopped Hitler before World War II, and her destiny is to stop Hitler. And watching her gradually move towards that while also discovering what life was like in England at that time period, you know, during the Great War and then between the wars, it's just fascinating. The detail is so rich. The characters are so interesting. And as a writer, it is a masterclass. I'm reading it for probably the fourth or fifth time right now.
She's done a sequel as well. I can't remember the name of it. Have you read
it's
that?
It's A God in Ruins, right. And I can't get into it. I'm hoping that the day will come when I can get past about page 10, but it didn't grab me the way Life After Life grabbed me.
Isn't that interesting? Because sometimes I have this and I'll really look forward to a book and I'll have the same. It'll just leave me a bit flat. And then I revisit it. And it happened to me with, I'm going to have a little Google. Oh my goodness. It was like my book of last year. They've just made it into a film. Where the Crawdads Sing. Thank you. Oof. God, having a proper senior moment there. First time read it and probably got about 10 pages in and I just wasn't in the mood. And then the next time I read it, I was straight in, devoured it, bored everyone senseless talking about it. And because I was clearly in a different headspace, maybe I had more time or less time, or the context was different, I don't know. But it just goes to show that sometimes you need to give books a second, third or fourth go. But when do you give up on a book if you're reading it and you're not enjoying it? Does it happen?
That's a great question. And honestly, if I can't get past about page 50, I pitch it. I love Donna Tartt, The Secret History. It's my favorite book in the whole world.
I know what you're going to say. Which one did you not like?
Her next book, The Little Friend.
Oh, no way!
It was dreadful. It was the first time in my life I binned a book.
You should see my copy of The Secret History. It's waterlogged. It is scratched up. It looks like it's been in a fight. Little Friend, I didn't mind, but her last book, which is an absolute brick, The Goldfinch, I really despised reading. And I wanted to like it so desperately that I kept on going and then resented the time I'd wasted. So I do, but I do feel that, you know, as we said, life is too short for books you're not enjoying, but it's not too short to reread books that you love. What else is on your list? You've mentioned Terry Pratchett. I have never read a single book by Terry Pratchett. Why should I, Alison?
Terry Pratchett is incredible because early Terry Pratchett, like the first 10 or 15 books, is lighthearted, simple.
That is a sign of a prolific writer. His early work, the first 10 or 15 books, which is what most authors would aspire to writing in their lifetime.
But as he gets into the Guards series about Samuel Vimes, the head of the Night Guard in the world that Terry Pratchett has created, all of a sudden he becomes a brilliant social satirist. He deals with how do you run a city? He deals with how do cultures clash with each other and, you know, how are we judging each other? He deals with racism. He deals with economic inequality. The Samuel Vimes boots theory has actually been cited by the Harvard Business Review, which is that a poor man will spend $10 a year on boots for really crummy boots. A rich man will spend $50 on a great pair of boots that lasts 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, the poor man has spent twice as much as the rich man and still has wet feet. And I mean, this is a brilliant economic theory that has made it into the economics lexicon. But he's so funny. He's so clever. I really admire his use of footnotes to make sly little asides to the reader. And I just love how he looks at the workings of a great big city and all the cultures interacting in it, much like Dubai, and kind of assesses how do all these people get along? How do we find that common ground? And it's hilarious at the same time.
You've inspired me. And that's why I like talking to Alison, because you get me excited about reading and writing again. Thank you so, so much. Always an absolute pleasure. Where can people check out you? And I know you've got a lot going on in terms of your coaching and your workshops as well.
I have a workshop coming up December the 8th for Creative Nonfiction Magazine. If you Google Creative Nonfiction Webinars, it'll pop right up. And it's called Why Is This Work Getting Rejected? Ooh. Moving from Rejection to Publication. And it's all about how to fix your work that is not getting accepted where you want it to be accepted.
Alison, you're an absolute star. Thank you so, so much. Alison K. Williams there. And loving your messages about the books that you have read, loved and reread. Tuesdays with Maury, says Savita, an absolute tearjerker. Rishi's in the middle of reading the complete works of George Orwell. Good for you. Ash is saying Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, hands down. I absolutely loved that as well. Saying I thought it was going to be a silly girly feelings drama type of book, but it was a roller coaster until the last page.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Hope you're having a wonderful, magic, not manic Monday today. In conversation now with Candice Carty-Williams, an award-winning author who was in town recently for the Sharjah International Book Fair. She wrote the Sunday Times best-selling book Queenie about a Jamaican British woman living in London, straddling two cultures, slotting into neither and leading a bit of a messy life. It resonated with more than 150,000 people and is now being turned into a Channel 4 series, which I'm really excited to watch. When we spoke, I was in a coffee shop. She was in Sharjah. We made it work and I asked her, what's the process been like?
It's been a really interesting process. It's been quite tough in that, you know, I was able to write this novel and I didn't have to think about a word count. I was just kind of like, okay, what do you want to talk about? What do you want to say about this girl? And then suddenly you're in a room with people who are like, okay, you have to distill every episode into 24 pages. And so that's been quite hard for me because I've always been a writer that just likes to really get into it.
A creative challenge that you're enjoying or one that makes you want to, you know, throw your phone out of the window?
Sometimes both, but it's interesting. I think there is an enjoyment in being able to change your craft in a different way. You know, it's interesting to be succinct in your work, you know, and thinking about how you say more by saying less.
Which brings me to your new book, which is your first young adult novella, which came out last month. Again, a different sort of villain. Huge congratulations on that. I love the idea of you exploring, well, it's been described as a kind of a South London's answer to Freaky Friday. Can you tell us a little bit about the concept?
Of course. So I've always, since I was young, since I was at school, kind of looked at my friends and my peers and been like, oh, that's an interesting life. I wonder what that's like. And I've always been an advocate of, you know, good times and bad, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. And so when I was approached by Nights Off, which is a children's publisher, young adult publisher, and the first diverse publisher of its kind in the UK, do you want to write and what are you thinking of? And that kind of came to me very easy. I was like, oh, why don't I just do a body swap? Because I always think about class, and I think about how the class system in the UK is still quite rigid and still quite restrictive, especially if you're lower class, and how that actually plays out and how that affects young people. And you know, and I think, you know, young people, we don't really think about what that is like, the offshoot of having parents who don't have money. Like, what does it mean when you have to look after yourself? And that's financially, but also emotionally, you know, what are the repercussions of that? And so getting into these characters and just making them swap lives meant that we didn't just see what it was like to swap lives, but it also made us have a look at what it was like in those different lives too. And so I actually found that really, it was quite sad to write. I found that really upsetting because, you know, Empress, who is a character who's from a low socioeconomic background, she has it really hard and she's a really good girl who was just really smart and trying to make her way. And it was really hard to think about all of the girls like her. She's super bright, but they just don't have their chance to shine because of the life that they've been born into. You know, a lot of people we know kind of are able to coast through because they have money, and just thinking about the differences there. So I found it really, really tough to write, but really rewarding ultimately.
Adults need to read more, as do kids. Is it true you're donating your advance to a UK charity?
Yeah, so my advance is going to it's going to an organisation called Milk Honey Bees, run by this amazing young woman called Ebonita Iberi, and she has set up this space that is for young Black and mixed race women, for them to go and to learn. When we did a photo shoot for them, I was like, oh, by the way, I don't think anyone's told you, but I'm giving you guys advance. And she started crying in front of me, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, what have I done? And I don't think that you realize when you get to certain points in your life that actually, like, that money just makes a huge, huge difference to someone who wouldn't even dream of just accepting an amount of money and being like, oh yeah, okay, thanks. You know, like, I'm used to being around a lot of people to whom money is kind of like a given and it's part of their lives.
I know through the power of Instagram stalking, you've been meeting some students here in the UAE. It looked lovely. What were some of the questions they were asking you about your life as a writer?
It was really interesting. It was an interesting conversation. It was almost like a back and forth. So I would ask them questions and they would ask me questions because obviously, you know, I am very curious about every and any culture that isn't my own. And just thinking about what they do and what they study and what their aspirations are. They were, I think, a lot of business studies students. And so I was interested in like what they want to do. And they were like, yeah, well, I'm obviously going to, like, you know, finish my learning and start a business. And it was like, okay, that's amazing. You know, and I would never, I couldn't ever and that they would they but they were asking some you know they were asking like, what kind of things did you read, but also they were like, and like, you know, so do you do writing as a hobby or is it your job now, and also asking about like, you know, are you well paid, like do you enjoy it, can you live off of that. You know, there are very serious young women asking me very serious questions, but I think that these questions are really important, and I don't shy away from questions like that because it's real. And you know, it's, you want to know, like, do you get a living? Do you earn a living from this? Like, is it worth doing?
And interestingly, for you, you know, when you wrote Creedy, you were working in publishing, marketing exec, and now you're writing full time. Like, could you ever imagine that life for yourself a couple of years ago?
No, never. And it's like coming here to Sharjah and being like, wow, like writing has brought me to a place that I never would have, you know, I wouldn't even have been able to afford to explore. You know, I hadn't, when I was writing at that point, I hadn't left the country for years. I hadn't been able to take a holiday from work and go anywhere in memory. And so, you know, writing has brought me to all of these places. And, you know, as I say, I love to, as a person, as a writer, I just love to learn more about all of these places. And the world is so big, you know, it's bigger than South London, but for a long time, I hadn't seen anything like that.
Chatting with author Candice Carty-Williams, who wrote the award-winning book Queenie, we talked about that fateful retreat with best-selling author Jojo Moyes, where she started writing her own bestseller. With that wealth of experiences, I asked her, what are her predictions on future subjects for work?
You know what? I think I would always love to... I will always write my characters based on people who are learning too. I would never... I don't know if I would ever be comfortable writing a character who is from a completely different background to me and saying that that was their experience, because I can be a visitor still, but it doesn't mean that I understand that, you know, I'm from a different culture and I get to see different sides to places, but I'm not truly inside it. And one of my favorite writers, Kit DeVall, she once said that when you're writing other characters, tread where you want to, but tread carefully. And I think that's a really important way of thinking about writing other cultures, other people, because I respect them so much that I don't think I would dare to just say, I am this character from this country. This is what it's like. Maybe one of my characters will visit Sharjah. Who knows?
I would love that. Would you mind taking us back to the writing process of Queenie, the beginning? What was that kind of switch?
I'd done a screenwriting course as like a hobby a few years before. But when it came to writing Queenie and wanting to write something, I just knew in my heart that I wanted to sit down and have time to write something that would represent me. I wanted to just talk about what my life was like, the stories that I heard, the things that I'd seen, the things that I'd gone through, the dates that me and my friends had been on. I just wanted to have that. I really did just sit and I wrote so much in the first night. I knew that the privilege of being in that space and of being in Jojo Moyes's, you know, on her estate effectively, I knew that that was amazing. And I kind of wrote as much as I could. And by the end, when I left, I'd written about 40,000 words because I was like, you've just got to get it done. Yeah, after a week. And then also I got to spend time with her family and I got to drive around the area she lives in. It was really important. She lives in and around some woods, and it was nice to be with nature and be out of South London just for a bit, you know. And so, yeah, it was really good for my mind and really good to have that space and good to, you know, just physically be away from this place that I'd always been in, because at the time of writing, I lived in this really tiny studio flat and it was like full of mold and mice and slugs. It was just like everything you could name. So when I left, it was really, really nice to just be in a different space and a different headspace. And so then when I got back, I just wrote every single weekend until the first draft was done. I said to my friends, like, you're not going to see me for a while, because it was super important to me to just finish that project, because I felt like there was something in it. And I felt like, also, I wanted it to get out there. I wanted it to be out there so that people could relate to it, could enjoy it, could feel less lonely, you know?
For anyone who is listening and feels like they have a book or a character or a nugget of an idea in them, but perhaps don't have the concentration or the confidence to get it out, what would you say?
I would say, as I said yesterday to the students, just believe in yourself and believe that whatever your story is, it is important. And people will care about it. And I think that's always the thing. And that's what I needed to hear. And I need to hear all the time that you have to just believe in what you're doing and really back yourself, because you have to be your first supporter. You know, you will have other supporters. You will have amazing friends and amazing family and amazing colleagues maybe. But you need to believe in yourself. And that is really that's how you're going to get it out of yourself.
And what's next for you? As I said, I know you're working on a couple of adaptations for small screen. Empress Nia is out now. Is there another book upcoming that you're working on, writing?
Yeah. Well, I'm at the final edit of my second novel, my second full adult novel, People Person. I've just seen the cover. It is absolutely mind blowing. And I just, it's, you know, it was a thing also that kind of kept me company in lockdown, that writing that book kept me company, and those characters that were always in my brain, always having an argument. There are five half siblings who we're following in the book, and their wayward dad. All of those arguments they would have and what they got up to was the thing that kind of kept me company.
That moment of seeing a cover, that must be mind blowing to have someone read your words and then have that interpreted. Is it often match what you would have chosen, or is it completely different direction?
For Queenie, that was the first one that really blew my mind. That was the American editor had gone away. She'd said to me, she'd come to London and she was like, I'm just thinking about these things. I want it to be this, I want it to be that. And then she showed me the cover and I was like, how did you do that? Because, you know, it was kind of perfect. It was this every black woman who didn't necessarily, she didn't need to have a face because it could be anyone. So when it came to this one, we've worked with this incredible illustrator who does not take commissions, but she said for this. And when I first saw what she'd done, I was breathless. It was brilliant.
Candice Carty-Williams, I can't wait to get my hands on her second novel and watch Queenie on TV.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.